Well, welcome. I'm Kevin Dindalk. I'm the director of the Henry Institute here at Calvin College that focuses on the study of Christianity and politics. That's the full name, the Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics. So the two things that you are not supposed to talk about in polite company, and we do them both together. I also, in the political science department, teach there. And so a lot of my research is on religion and politics and teaching on religion and politics, and do some work, especially recently, on religion and politics and cross-national perspective. But a lot of my early work was on American politics primarily. So we are going to talk about religion and politics together today, those things that we're not supposed to talk about polite company. I think you probably are polite company. But we typically say that we don't talk about those two things together because it generates conflict, right? That people take offense. And for someone like me, looking at it as a social scientist, looking at this conflict as a social scientist, I tend to look at that as a conflict over identity. Because after all, both religion and politics are markers of identity. They tell us something, our political views and behaviors, our religious views and behaviors, tell us something about our purposes, about our beliefs, about the world around us, about the values that we place in relationships, relationships to each other, relationships to the environment around us. And so those are all markers of identity in ways that, you know, selecting preferences for ice cream or something are not, right? And so they create conflict because talking about them creates conflict because it becomes a threat to our identity itself. To be in a discussion about religion or a discussion about politics or a discussion about the two put together, and those discussions inevitably might lead to critique, right? Being confronted with ideas that you disagree with, and that can feel like a threat to identity. The response that many people take to that threat to identity is not to say, hey, I want more of this, right? So you see the title, Faithful Citizenship in a Pluralistic World, you know, and in some way you might say, well, wouldn't that be great if we had this really robust pluralism, that the response to these threats that people might feel is just to invite some more of it, right? To say, hey, I'm going to immerse myself fully in the diversity of conceptions of the good, and really test myself in this pluralistic world. But of course, the response for a lot of people is to say, well, because I'm being threatened in my identity itself, I'm going to withdraw. So the response tends to be a kind of polarization. Now, I have a couple. I'm not going to show all the slides that I have. We'll see where this conversation goes. I've got lots of slides, and I can show you different. But this is not going to be a PowerPoint presentation. But I do want to show you a couple of things. I'm going to skip these for a second. This is one representation of polarization, right? And you've become familiar if you watch media portrayals of presidential elections over the last 12 years. You've seen a map like this. These maps became especially popular after the 2000 election, Bush versus Gore. They really picked up a head of steam in the 2004 election, and today we see something like this. Ordinarily, it would be red, blue. I don't know what that color is. The projector is not rendering it quite in red and blue. But, you know, it's a typical kind of story of polarization, right? We've got these states in the upper plains, down into the south, voting largely Republican. We've got states in the upper Midwest, in New England, and in the west, typically voting Democratic. Maybe you haven't seen this one. This is the same sort of map, but instead of looking at it by state, it's looking at by county. And, you know, you might look at this and say, well, wait a second, 2012, I believe a Democrat won. Right? But it looks like there's a whole lot more red than there is blue. But of course, that just has to do with population density. So you can see this megalopolis here is largely blue. LA, San Francisco, Seattle, blue, Chicago, and so forth. So where there's population density, we see a lot of Democratic voting. And that has something to do with a gap or rural urban gap and so forth. So this was used as evidence of a kind of polarization. Now, political scientists look at that and say, well, it's somewhat controversial to claim that that's polarization. Yeah, it's red and blue, and it looks like the nation is polarized. But there's a lot of stuff going on in those counties, right? There's a big story in each one of those counties that doesn't always get told when we just say, well, it's red or blue. And so you maybe have seen, I don't have this map, but maybe you've even seen the U.S. in purple, right? Where each county is rendered in the shade of red or blue or the combination of the two depending on the percentage of the vote. And so it becomes this, the U.S. actually becomes in that map a kind of purple haze. So that might suggest there isn't polarization. Political scientists disagree about this. And not that this matters, but I might lay my cards on the table about the polarization debate. Some political scientists say we're polarized, not really at a mass level, not in a deep way. The electorate, all of us, we're not really polarized. We're not at different poles. We can still talk to each other in some ways. We're somewhere down the middle on most things. But it only looks like we're polarized because we happen to be in a system in the United States, and this is true in some other places, but in slightly different ways. But all of our political choices get channeled into two options, right? So it looks like we're polarized, but really we're pluralistic. It just so happens that our elected officials are polarized, right? So you may have heard the story about you can't find liberal Republicans from the Northeast anymore. You can't find conservative Democrats from the South anymore. And that's really happened just in the last 20 years where there's been this resorting. And so Congress becomes polarized and lots of state legislatures are polarized. And we have to make a choice. We got this group or that group. And so we look polarized because we have only these two choices. That's called elite level polarization. And there are some political scientists who argue that's really the polarization we see. It doesn't go deeper down. I happen to be one of the political scientists who argues that, in fact, it goes deeper down, that we are polarized at a mass level. And that might come up in the rest of our conversation today. It might not. But what I want to do today is to say, all right, if we have a kind of polarized response to this identity that we have as citizens and as faithful disciples, how might we think about that? And how might we think especially about the way the church plays a role in the forming of good citizens? What is the role of the church, in the formation of good citizens? What would it look like for the church in its liturgies? What would it look like for the church in the way it does the sacraments? Would it look like for the church in the way it preaches, in the church in the way we engage in public prayer together? What would it look like in the sending of all of us out into the world at the end of a Sunday service? What would it look like for adult education programs, for spiritual formation programs, programs for kids, all of these kinds of things? What would it look like if they were oriented in some way to thinking about what it means to be a good citizen? Should we even talk in those terms? Put my cards on the table, I'm almost always going to say, yes, we ought to be thinking, at least in part, in those terms. There are lots of reasons for that. One reason is that our citizenship, our status as citizens in some place, is inescapable, right? And if the church is supposed to be engaging us in all areas of our life, and this is an inescapable area of our life, whether we like it or not, the church ought to be engaging it, right? But I think there are some more principled reasons for that just than saying, hey, this is an inescapable part of life, and so the church ought to be doing something with it. So, what I'd like to do today is to sort of lay out a framework for the way political scientists, other social scientists, try to think about good citizenship and how good citizens are formed. And then perhaps we'll have some opportunity for some discussion about what the church, how the church might play a role in this kind of formation, if it ought to play that role at all. Okay, but I really would like to focus on this kind of framework for understanding good citizenship. So to do that, we really have to start with a key question, which is, what's a good citizen in the first place? What does a good citizen possess? It's quite a loaded term, good citizen. It suggests that there are some bad ones. But, you know, what are those characteristics? So let me throw that out. I mean, when I say good citizen, I mean, you could word associate on it. You hear that. What does a good citizen possess?
I mean, apart from agreeing with us.
Apart from agreeing with you. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Right. Well, I mean, this is, you know, what is the definition of a good citizen? It might be, in part, you know, having certain kinds of purposes, certain kinds of goals, and then we have to debate, you know, what those goals are, right? And we may very much like somebody to agree with what ours are. But, you know, what are some other than agreement? We're probably not going to get that. So are there other kinds of characteristics? Yeah?
I would suggest a primary commitment to community.
Okay.
To the formation and enhancement of community.
Yeah. So there has to be some sort of other-centered orientation, and it has to be connected to community in some way. Now, of course, we could define that. When you say community, what do you mean? What do you think of?
I think of how we all live together, and then you can attach things like justice and compassion,
sure,
and so on. But how do we enhance a body sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we can think about it in a somewhat abstract, and that isn't a bad word here, but an abstract sense of we're committed to the common good of a community, or the sometimes it gets a phrase of the public interest. Common good has a more of a religious connotations, right? In Christian faith, commitment to a certain understanding of the common good is important, lots of different traditions. But we can also think about community as a particular place, right? So maybe we think, a commitment to the local or the national or even the global. A lot of my work recently has been on religious persecution around the globe and to what extent the North American church ought to be engaging the different types of groups on the issue of persecution around the globe, right? So we could start thinking about place, right? A commitment to community that's embedded in certain places, right? And these are not mutually exclusive. Yeah, commitment to what the common good looks like at the local level and national level, subnational level, states and provinces and so forth, and maybe even at the global level itself, okay? So that may be a characteristic of a good citizen. And I want to get to that in a little bit because I think we could talk about this as there's certain dispositions that somebody has if they have this commitment to the common good or to community. What else?
Maybe this is repeating, but I just thought of it before you said all that more articulately than I. Just to be a good neighbor.
Yeah.
If I'm able to begin there.
Yeah.
If I can't do that,
right.
I can't. You know,
right.
Reach out further.
Right. So neighborliness, in fact, one of the best studies by political scientists recently of the role of religion in civic life has a chapter about neighborliness. It's titled, What Does It Mean to Be a Good Neighbor? Something along those lines. There's another hand. Yeah.
Willingness to participate in the process.
Yeah. So do you even have a disposition to participate? You might say I have a certain purpose, but I might be disengaged, right? So am I participating? Do I have a disposition to participate? What else?
Very similar to that, a commitment to the institutions that we identified as making good citizens, the public school.
Right.
Committed to being on the board or helping run elections, those sorts of civic duties.
Okay, so a commitment to institutions, certain kinds of associations or institutions that quite often are forming citizens in the first place, right? And that would suggest that we could, you know, we can measure that. We could look at that. We're going to look at some measures of this in a bit. But, you know, do I have confidence in institutions that do this? Do I view those institutions as responsive to me? Do I think they're even doing good in the world? I mean, there's lots of different ways that we can measure that. But institutional or associational life has become really important subject for social scientists in general, in part because of this concern that it's declining, right? And that that's going to have an effect on the way we act as citizens and at whether we're even forming a disposition toward community or toward the common good. There's another hand.
It's like, I think it's from Oxfam, they say citizenship is to be one outraged by social injustice.
Yeah, okay. So it isn't just, so you can have a commitment to an institution, set of institutions, while at the same time being a dissenter, right? Being countercultural in some ways.
So you can appreciate the common good, but not have any kind of passion or affect toward injustice.
Right, right. Yeah. What else? What else do you need? What do you need to be a good citizen?
Citizenship.
Yeah, you need citizenship, exactly. Now, I think what you're bringing up, tell me if this is wrong, but we often make this, people like me, make this distinction. You know, citizenship as a legal status and citizenship as a cultural identity, right? And some of what you've been describing is citizenship as a cultural identity. But that engagement, just being able to participate, sometimes is closed off to people, right? So that legal status is this precondition.
Correct. Of
being able to even have a certain kind of identity.
So I know,
right?
Immigrants who are illegal, who have all those, are going to be sent back to their homes.
Yeah.
And they've been here a long time.
So we can look at certain groups of people in society who are challenged in that kind of legal status more than others.
Right.
So immigrants, in certain states, people who have been convicted of certain kinds of felonies can lose civic privileges, including the right to vote. There are lots of other things that we look at where the legal status of citizenship, we would say, yeah, it really is a precondition of being able to fully participate. And for a lot of people, that's closed off, right? So there is that legal dimension. Yeah.
I mean, I would argue that there's a socioeconomic privilege to being able to engage in all of those institutions and have it. Maybe not the predisposition for injustice, but many of the others, the ability to participate, requires a certain level of economic stability, of internal resources, emotional resources.
Right. So socioeconomic status, a variety of other sociodemographic characteristics really help us predict whether somebody is going to be able to engage, have the dispositions to engage, and so forth, have the knowledge to engage. And that's something we haven't mentioned. Quite often, you know, when people talk about citizenship, just talk about the informed citizen, that, you know, just having basic sort of knowledge about how institutions work. And that lack of knowledge is highly correlated with socioeconomic status. So we've got several things on the table, right? A disposition toward community, certain other kinds of characteristics that have to do with attachment to institutions, right? Actual participation, engagement, and that can be related to your legal status. But even if you have a legal status that allows you to participate, you might still be apathetic. The vast majority of people who don't turn out to vote, for example, have the right to vote. And so it's a precondition, but it isn't sufficient. It's necessary, but not sufficient. So lots of different elements. One other thing that we often talk, political scientists often talk about, is civic skills. So what kinds of leadership skills, communication skills, skills with numbers, understanding how numbers work, all those kinds of capacities, those skills are important ingredients to citizenship. So when you start doing this, yeah, go ahead, Terrence.
No, it wasn't a hand to interrupt. You can finish.
Oh, no, good. Please interrupt me because I'm about to pick up the chalk.
Okay.
And that happens. You don't know where this might go. Yeah.
I think as a piece of the puzzle, I don't know if this is out the box or what. But it seemed like it's underestimated, but that's health.
Yeah.
That health and fitness,
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
I think, and that's mental health as well.
Yeah.
I think it plays a huge part.
Fascinating.
You can contribute to relationships.
Yeah.
You might contribute, but you can be a grumpy contributor.
Yeah.
You can not love. You can, health can affect a whole lot of things, and it can affect the longevity.
Yeah, what a great point. I don't think a political scientist has ever studied that, health. Especially, but you're suggesting, you know, mental health, physical health, these again are all sort of preconditions of even being able to engage, right? Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
I'm thinking of a responsibility of being a good citizen in the world. And that requires, dignity of everyone in the area, and also the responsibility of the environment.
Yeah. Okay, so that you are, so perhaps part of the common good is that you recognize other people as carrying dignity. In a Christian context, we might call that, you know, image bearing, right? Image bearers of God. But in addition, you know, how we engage, does the common good include not just our relationships with other human beings, but I'm assuming by the environment you mean the natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how are we relating to the natural environment as well? So, you know, what does, sort of filling in, what does the common good start to look like? All right. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the parameters of good citizenships, too. I mean, in some states I can go buy an AK-47, I'm a good citizen.
But yeah.
Use the AK-47 in a manner which is not consistent with the citizenship in which I'm living with, then I become an outcast.
Yeah. Right.
So I can go hunting with it and target shooting with it, you know, and other things with it. But if I go in a room and start shooting people who are not shooting back at me, then I'm no longer a good citizen.
Yeah.
So there's parameters, I think, of that.
Just Yeah. I mean, and those parameters aren't always just defined by law. They're sometimes defined by cultural norms and ideas. Yeah. Yeah. So now, if I were a political scientist, I am. So when political scientists try to put this together, they almost never will talk about the common good, just to start there. For political scientists, the way you model that is to say everybody has interests. Right, and we just aggregate all those interests. We combine them, and that's the good. But we don't want to say anything about the common good. I want to come back to that, though. I know that feels, but that's sort of political scientists borrowing from economics, right? We just all have a bunch of interests, and we compete over those interests. That's the typical model that we use for even thinking about politics. But we can look at some other pieces of this. So we'll talk about certain kinds of civic capacities, so the knowledge and the skills that we mentioned earlier, right? What kind of knowledge do I have about the political world around me? Political scientists often measure that in some, admittedly really lame ways. So we'll ask people, you know, who's the vice president? Who's the speaker of the House? Who's the president of Russia? That sort of thing. But of course, you want to ask some deeper questions about, you know, what do you know about history? Right? What do you know about how we came to be the type of people we are, and so forth? But knowledge becomes an important piece of good citizenship. Capacities or skills, civic skills, become an important part of good citizenship. So leadership, communication skills, numeracy, other things along those lines. But most, and I want to set those aside for right now, as important as they are. Most importantly, I think, for our conversation here are civic dispositions. And in this room, I'd call those civic virtues, okay? And it sort of gets at a variety of the points that you're making here about how we engage, where we engage, how do we engage institutions, and so forth. So, you know, when you think about, especially democratic citizenship, there are very clear kinds of dispositions that are important to being able to make collective decisions, which we try to do in democracies. Some of those are very thin kinds of virtues. You might not even want to call them virtues. So one example is tolerance, the disposition to put up with stuff that you find noxious, morally objectionable, right? Tolerance isn't accepting things or respecting things. It's putting up with things that you really dislike. So maybe that's a key virtue in a democracy. We could also, though, talk about other virtues that maybe have a little more resonance with the Christian faith. Patience, humility. These are civic virtues among other types of virtues. And we can talk about why we might call them virtues. Perhaps most importantly and most studied by political scientists recently is trust. So if you think about decisions that we make together, there's almost always some basis of interpersonal trust in those decisions. You're going to live up to your end of the bargain. I'll live up to my end of the bargain. If I don't believe you're going to live up to your end of the bargain, why would I enter into a collective decision with you, right? So interpersonal trust becomes very important. In addition, trust in institutions, right? So what we typically call that is forgive this. This is too jargony. I shouldn't do this, but I just have to say it. External political efficacy. Well, what is that? Efficacy. Efficacy is your perception that your participation matters. External efficacy means that institutions out there are responsive to me. Government responds to me when I cry out to it, right? If it's responsive to me, then I might start to think, oh, my participation matters. External efficacy, external political efficacy. That's crucially important to try to measure and to think through. A crucially important kind of disposition of a citizen. And there are lots of others we could talk about. Well, about 20, 30 years ago, political scientists started to get especially interested in dispositions like trust, confidence in institutions, external political efficacy, because there was a perception that those dispositions, not perception, a lot of evidence, that those dispositions were in decline. So if any of you have run across a name like Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, that's a line of argument that suggests, yeah, we're seeing this decline in people's attachment to institutions, and that has all sorts of effects on what they value and how they engage with each other in public life. So, yeah, we could talk about that one later. But here's a couple of those measures. One is trust in government. This is starting in 1958. You don't have to be able to read these numbers. 1958, 2012, okay? And this is a question that's asked in a survey every couple of years. You know, to what extent do you trust government? There's some particular ways of asking that question. The key thing for our purposes is the blue line, right? It's in decline. People are, you know, there's been this overall decrease in the level of trust. Sometimes it spikes. You know, Ronald Reagan comes in and promises morning in America. Early 2000s, you see a spike in large measure because it's a rally effect after 9/11. But generally speaking, the trend line goes down. External political efficacy, that disposition I described earlier. About three-quarters of the American public had this very strong sense that the government was responsive to them in 1958. Today, it's barely it's just over a third of the American public sees government as responsive. This is actually breaking it out by education, which is a rough measure of socioeconomic status. So if you start to ask questions like, do public officials care what I think? Which is a measure of efficacy. You could see how the top bar, the top line, I mean, is highest educated. The bottom line is lowest educated, and you can see that it matters, your level of education, whether you think public officials are responsive to you. This one, for our group, is important to look at, percentage of Americans with high confidence in organized religion. What this is suggesting, the reason I put this in here is twofold. One is that here we are at this particular conference, but the second is that it also gives you an indication that the decline in trust, confidence, efficacy is almost across the board with institutions. The church being this very important institution, of course, but we're seeing this in, you know, confidence in police, confidence in schools, confidence in name your institution. There are some that it's a little hazier, like business. There seems to be some polls increasing confidence there. That's another conversation. But you can see the decline, right? So you go from two-thirds of the American public having confidence, high confidence in organized religion. Today it's about 40%. Yeah.
There's a huge drop from 9/11 after.
Yeah.
It looks like from 60 to 45.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
Comments?
Yeah, so... Right, so this is 2002 or late 2002.
Right.
So you do get this little spike, which is, you know, this radiating effect of the rallying effect, right? So everybody is saying, we got to rally around institutions. We have to rally around societal structures, right? We're under an attack here. This is a threat to our way of life. So we rally around the institutions. That declines very quickly across the board. So part of what we're seeing is just that across the board decline. In addition, what you're probably seeing in that 45% is the fact that you're going to see some of this kind of random variation in polls. So really, I should have put the line in here, because what you really want to see is just the trend line, what cuts across it.
Yeah, it's just that it's very dramatic.
Yeah, it's precipitous, isn't it? Yeah, you get a 15 percentage point drop. Yeah, that's a good question. I beyond those two explanations, this general effect on institutions, because I don't know if you remember, but, you know, within 2 years, that rally effect had actually reversed significantly when it came to the state, when it came to popularity of the president. All those kinds of things went down very quickly, which is typical. Right. Yeah.
Quick question, for everybody. When did social media get really open?
Oh, yeah.
I'm asking because I have a second part question.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is iPhone is 2007, I believe. Yeah. It's a relatively recent addition. The use of the internet in the mass population is really starts to get cooking in the mid-1990s. But, you know, having the phone like you have right there, this isn't 10 years old yet. It's not 10 years old.
5 was Facebook.
Yeah, so I was just thinking when you're talking about confidence and you're talking about violence amongst institutions and citizens, it may have happened prior to, but once it began to get in our hands, we could see that potentially contributing from 05 to now.
There's little doubt, I would say, in the literature on this, that social media is having an effect on people's attachment to not just institutions, but to each other.
Right.
But the fact is that the trend line starts before social media,
right?
So you can't put that all on the fact that we have smartphones.
I heard someone say that we have an emotional secession from one another.
Yeah.
Going on in our culture, and I think that's a powerful way of putting it.
Yeah.
When was this Catholic Church scandal broke? When did that break?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, of course. I'm sure that was a piece of it. Yeah. Yeah, I remember. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up because now that I think of it, there actually are some studies that look at that period of time and its effect on people's view of the church broadly construed, not just the Catholic Church. That's right. That's a piece of it. Okay, so let's get to this question. Let's get to it in a particular way. We've got 15 minutes. I'm going to really cram this in. So.
This session goes to
happen. Oh, that's right. Nice. So I could just relax. Anyway, so... Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's right. I was looking at this. I have to really start shaking here. So political scientists ask, well, we can see all these declines, and that, you know, from our perspective, political scientific perspective, it looks like this is going to start having an effect on all these dispositions that we've always associated with belonging to these associations, right? So people seem to be disaffected, dropping out, and that's going to have an effect then on their levels of interpersonal trust, on their levels of efficacy, on other kinds of things. So what do we, how should we sort of analyze this? Well, you can see on the board what looks like an incomprehensible sketch. But what it's really showing is a way that lots of social scientists have tried to explain what we're seeing here. These declining levels of confidence and so forth. So think about it this way. Stick person, We have an individual, right? An individual citizen engaging with the state. Now, if an individual citizen, if none of this were here, don't look at that yet, but if you're just engaging the state as one person against this large institution with violent coercive power, let's just say you've got long odds, right? If you're trying to advocate for yourself, advocate your interests, advocate the common good, whatever, however you want to put it, if you're trying to push back against government on your own, that's a problem. And in fact, what we sometimes do with this, what political scientists sometimes do, is to use that particular model to explain totalitarianism. That if it's just a group of individuals who have to engage the state directly, the state has such a great deal of power that it can impose itself on people and bend their will to what the state wants, right? But what happens in places where we don't see totalitarianism? What is it that pushes between the individual and the state, sits between the individual and the state? Well, that diagram, which I drew earlier, below, is meant to be a diagram of civil society. And what that is a set of voluntary associations and organizations that mediate between the individual and the state. Voluntary associations that mediate between the individual and the state. So we're talking here about labor unions, schools, soccer leagues. Robert Putnam's book is Bowling Alone, bowling leagues. Lots of other types of associations, just name your favorite. That biggest circle, in the U.S. at least, is religion, faith-based. So in the U.S., in terms of voluntary associations within civil society, religious associations of various sorts occupy about half the space. And we're talking about not just churches, but also faith-based hospitals, nonprofits, other kinds of organizations. But organizations that are driven by some kind of faith commitment occupy about half the space in civil society. Well, if you think about it, now, instead of the individual engaging the state directly, the individual is part of civil society, and civil society can push back against the state, engage the state, right? So there's a relationship of the individual to the state through civil society. It's a whole lot easier to engage the state if, say, you're a retiree and you are a member of the AARP.
Absolutely.
Right? Now, you know, we can talk about the AARP, but I will set that aside. But, I mean, whether, you know, your views of the AARP. But the point is, right, there's a strength in numbers. The state has an impact on civil society. It can try to constrain it through legal conditions and constraints. It can allow a great deal of freedom in civil society. It can have a First Amendment that says there's freedom of religion and freedom of association and so forth to allow some degree of growth and association here. But civil society also, so you can start to see arrows going in lots of different directions, it has this impact on the individual, right? So the fact that we are members of associations, of churches and bowling leagues and so forth, shapes us. It forms us. It forms our dispositions. So if you think about just one disposition, the disposition of trust, interpersonal trust. You belong to a church. You develop trusting relationships within that church, right? You start to trust your fellow congregants, and they trust you. You bond with those fellow congregants. You trust that they're going to live up to their end of the bargain if you decide you're going to do something, and they trust you'll do the same. Political scientists, sociologists, and so forth will call that bonding trust, right? We start to develop these bonded relationships. And sometimes those bonds can be extremely intense, very strong, especially in highly bounded churches with high boundaries, high walls. So you develop really intense relationships of trust. But the question for citizens, that happens within an association. But the question for citizenship is then, do I develop a disposition of trust that matters outside the church, right? Do I start to trust people in other associations, other areas of my life? Do I trust institutions even, right? That's called bridging trust. So we can develop certain levels of bonding trust that don't bridge, right? That don't move outside of this church to this association or that association, right? Where we start to see people develop stronger bridging trust and so forth is when they belong to lots of different associations that interact. They've got a rich network within civil society. And they are reaching across lines of difference, right? They're not just hanging out with people of like mind within their church, but they're engaging in these other associations where they're exposed to other kinds of views, and that allows them to develop this kind of bridging trust. Same sort of thing could be said about tolerance. Levels of tolerance go up when you are engaged across lines of difference, other kinds of dispositions that we associate with citizenship. You can look at the other characteristics of good citizens, too. You get push aside civic dispositions or virtues. You look at civic skills. Where do you learn leadership, communication, other things? Does it just come out of nowhere? Well, it's typically that you are involved in some sort of association, right? You're in a church or a bowling league or a whatever, a labor union. And all of a sudden, you find yourself on a committee, right? And before you know it, you probably have had this experience, you're chairing that committee, right? And you've never chaired a thing, but you're thrown into it and you've got to learn to lead, right? You've got to learn how to set an agenda, how to make good on that agenda, all the rest, right? These are leadership skills. You have to learn how to communicate. You might have to learn how to mess around with a spreadsheet. So you have to get some fiscal skills, numeracy. But you develop these skills within that context for those purposes, the purposes of the church or the bowling league or whatever it is. But those are skills that don't just sit there, right? Now you've got the skill. Now I know how to lead a committee or an organization. I know how to communicate well around an agenda. I can even read a spreadsheet. And so I learned it here, but it becomes something I can use here and here and here. You see? Dispositions, skills, even knowledge, these are transportable. They're transportable. We can use them outside of one context in other contexts. And that's why they become important to our citizenship, right? They don't just sit there in our church or our bowling league. They become dispositions we can use as citizens in general. So if there's a decline in our engagement in these associations, or if our engagement in these associations has changed so that we're not really engaging across lines of difference anymore, but instead the circles look a little bit like this. My church sits over here, and it doesn't really engage with anything over there, right? The circles become disconnected. It's no longer really a Venn diagram, right? If that's happening, then you don't develop those same kinds of bridging dispositions, transportable civic skills, and so forth. And how did you put it a second ago?
Secession of emotional contact.
Yeah, so secession of emotional contact. Look, I don't have contact, period, let alone emotional, right? So if I don't even have contact across lines of difference, if there's some level of polarization among all these associations, then I'm very unlikely to, you know, sort of have this disposition of being trusting of others or being tolerant of others and so forth. And so many political scientists, I happen to be one of them, would suggest that we're seeing a decline in associational life in two ways. One way is that fewer and fewer people are joining groups, period. And another way is that to the extent they are joining groups, they are increasingly polarized, right? They're increasingly in groups of like mind and not connected to other types of groups. We can see this in all kinds of ways. Probably the best way is in a not so much a civil society way, this kind of detachment that we have, but instead the big sort, housing. This is a slight representation of housing trends, but represented in terms of political choices. So you can't possibly read any of that. But this is a 1976 map of the U.S. in 1976 by county. This is a map in 2004. And it's showing congressional districts, or let's just call them for sake of argument, congressional districts. It's actually showing counties. But let's imagine that each of those borders is a congressional district. And it's showing how competitive those districts are. Why does that matter? Well, if a district was competitive, it means that there's a diverse group of people there, right? And they're competing with each other. And there are elected officials who are, or candidates in there who are saying, yeah, we can come to some sort of compromise vote for me. But, you know, there's competition. And so whenever you see on this map white, what you're seeing are competitive districts. By the time we get to 2004, a lot of the white is missing, right? We start to get districts that have been reordered, and there's a lot of explanation for this. Some of you know about gerrymandering and so forth, but there's a whole lot of explanation for this. But those districts, or in this case counties, become less competitive. How does it happen? Well, maybe it's gerrymandering, that's part of it, but it's also because of where people are choosing to live. Where people are choosing to live. This is partly a reflection of how we have sorted ourselves in terms of housing. I'm going to live in this neighborhood, and other people who are just like me are going to live in this neighborhood, and we all think the same about politics and about child raising, rearing and nearly everything else. And so that means it's going to get reflected in our vote choice in the presidential election, right? Well, that's one way of trying to sort of get a measurement of how we sort ourselves, and in that sorting are polarized from each other. There's all kinds of other pieces of evidence of this, right? So let me stop right here for a second. Thankfully, we have 15 more minutes. Thank you for giving me those. Does this make sense? Does this resonate? Are there ways that you'd want to push back at this kind of model of trying to understand our citizenship? Where does good citizen? What's the seedbed of good citizenship?
And like zooming out a little bit, where does commerce and
what a great question
dollars do those ultimately do the institution? Is Apple just a circle in there, or is the dollar the circle?
Yeah, that's a great question. So most social scientists, when they model this, put the market outside of civil society. That the market operates on the basis of a different kind of metric, right? So we have these voluntary associations, and you know they associate with the church and bowling leagues and all the rest, but that the marketplace is different. But I think you can still ask the question, to what extent does our work life and engaging in the marketplace shape us with these dispositions? You know, we should remind ourselves, especially as you know, in churches, how we talk about work life, that the vast majority of our time, of our time awake during the week, is spent at work, right? And quite often we're in a position in that context where we can't as easily sort. I have a job. I can't just sort of, I suppose, decide I'm going to get out of this. But quite often in that work, you're confronted with lots of people with whom you have disagreements, that you are, in a sense, by nature of the workplace, reaching across lines of difference, right? And having to engage other people. So usually it becomes the market is a circle over here somewhere, right? But you can ask the same questions. How does it form us, right? You could ask the question earlier, right? Does it form us with a vision of the common good, right? Is it possible to think about the marketplace as embedded with or having a vision of the common good, or is it all just about pursuit of our own self-interests, right? So it's a good question, and we can think about that too, right? Where does the market fit into this? Yeah.
So
really sudden practical question, personal maybe a little bit for you. Does your pastor pray for good citizens and for the common good? And how does he do that, or she?
Yeah. Well, I actually would much prefer to just throw that out to the entire group. No, but I would say that my pastor, and this is this typical, right, of public prayers, that the references to the common good are generic, right? They're non-specified, generally speaking. So we pray for justice. We pray for the poor as this abstract entity. We maybe pray for neighborhoods, but that there is a fear of getting more specific, in part because of where we started, right? Well, wait a second. I don't agree with that. I can't pray for that, right? And so that is... you know, I would suggest, and here I'm just being anecdotal because you asked me to be anecdotal, and there are very few studies of this. This is why I was saying I want to invite the conversation then about where do churches act formatively here? How could churches do that, including in worship? My impression is that to the extent churches even pray about public things, that it tends to be quite general, so that no one in the audience would be offended.
Right, it was like the issue of the bathroom issue. I forgot what state that, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And the shooting in Florida. Well, a generic prayer is, you know, pray for the state of North Carolina, general.
Yeah.
And we pray for the victims of the Florida tragedy without mentioning, so-called ISIS, Muslims, gay, straight, bi, mm-hmm. AK-47. Whatever, because, you know, you don't want to piss off, excuse me, anybody.
Yeah.
Especially if they're typing.
Right.
You know, I mean, be clear, right? You want to make sure that you know the guy works for the NIA, right?
Yeah.
And you know the policeman sitting over there, as well as the social activist and the social worker.
Yeah.
Well, those generic things, prayers, just makes everybody happy versus specifically digging deeper because, you know, you don't want to tick nobody off because you're supposed to be the man or woman talking about...
Which I'll push back and say that that's exactly what those prayers are designed to do, envelop everyone and be universal and not...
Oh, yeah. No, I think...
I'm
being sarcastic.
But, if the pastor does it from a message of we're going to exclude a certain segment of the population versus it becomes political, but you can still pray specifically without it being political. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think that's why we're all here, is because there's art in that. Mm-hmm. It's not a science. Mm-hmm. There's art in shaping that prayer.
Oh, you're not convincing me.
No, I'm just happy to be making eye contact with you. But that's why we're here. It's because it's art. It's not red and blue on a map. It's
right.
We can pray for the LGBT community. We can still pray for those NRA people. We can still pray for AR-15 toting mm-hmm. hunters, and we can still pray for those that, you know, want to.
But I would say the pushback, not that I am or not, is that place of where I've been, and a lot of they played safe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sadly, you know, that's why I probably left some of those places, because we all played it safe, too safe, to where you don't engage, in my opinion only, the congregation in issues that affect the common good, which is the policies that we are allowing to exist because we're not sort of throwing it into the prayer.
Yeah.
If you want to take off the NIA guy that gives a big check or somebody that pays silent, you know, you don't want to take, and I think this whole engagement by Jesus, if we believe in Jesus, hell, he pissed off everybody. I'm sorry. It's like, you know, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, this is a guy that, like, he was just, you know, he just, everywhere he went, he just agitated folk, and we don't agitate enough.
Yeah. Although he's, I think you're suggesting the agitation. When you look at the way Jesus does that, of course, the agitation is, there was an art to the agitation. Right? Yeah. The one thing I would just say, one of the assumptions in the way you describe this is that the congregation was diverse, right? So you're worried about angering different kinds of groups, but that assumes that you've got it. So, I mean, this church here,
I'm sorry. Back here, I'm sorry.
What's that?
Nothing.
No, but I bet this.
We're back here with my. I'm like, oh, they're on.
Oh, yeah, no. This is no, but it's, but I mean, this is a patriotic service on a Sunday morning. This is a Sunday morning service right around July 4, right? And so this may be a community where you could pray about particular kinds of things. And I don't want to stereotype here, but you could say there's a certain kind of unity here that makes it easier, right? So part of the challenge is the prayer in the context of pluralism, right? What is
everyone with perms?
Yeah, everyone with perms. Yeah, I don't know. Right. There was a... Yeah, go ahead.
That's a good question. So I just really say prayer in terms of pluralism, which I agree with.
Yeah.
But based on the maps, we're often not praying in pluralism.
Right.
We're praying in utter sameness and particularity.
Right.
Which makes Israel almost look diverse at that point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, ancient Israel.
Yeah.
So... I think it's a curious theological question or liturgical question to say, all right, how do you pray the art form? Were you actually in a Klan-looking congregation on July 4th?
I didn't know that was going to be the connotation here. Sorry. I was just looking at the bunting and the whatever.
You're looking at the flags.
Yeah, the flags, yeah.
I think there's a lot of worship minute to be made on naming particular things,
yeah.
Contrary to the demographic, where you say LGBTQ in the most unlikely church, and you say NRA in the most unlikely church, and
right.
You name the power structures without taking sides.
Yeah. So the naming, the framing, yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
However, in my experience, what that does is that it ends up with time, congregation there will end up all becoming a monolith, agreeing with the prayer. So for example, because I've been to churches where, you know, they're openly praying about the LGBT community, marriage equality. I'm doing an ethnography, and so I happen to be at this church the day after, Sunday after, the Supreme Court decision, they were celebrating.
Yeah.
The title of the sermon for the day was Love Wins. For over years, this congregation had become a monolith.
Right.
That this was prayed for.
Mm-hmm.
And they will not pray for the NRA member. They would, actually, in the country, they will pray that they die. That they could die away.
Yeah.
You know, that
die away. There we go. You know, okay. Yeah.
Part of the body politic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the question is, because if you
right.
So I think part of the leadership of worship, part of the leadership of the pastor is that if you focus in one way, then you end up having a monolith.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, the diversity will disappear. People will stop coming.
Yeah, people will stop, or they'll shop for another option.
Shop for another
place. Right. Yep. There was another.
Well, and how does that reconcile with the teaching that, you know, if your arm is not serving you, cut it off?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how do you reconcile that
mm-hmm.
if our prayers are meant to be truly universal?
Yeah, you want to?
Well, I just think that I come from an area that's very LGBTQ friendly, and I was speaking with someone earlier today, and it was a really good point. First off, I'll quote someone from the vigil that we held last week for the Orlando shootings who said that, "I don't need your prayers, I need your hands and your feet." And I think that part of what gets frustrating for members of the LGBT community is that that's where it stops, and that church believes that it's okay to pray in church and stop there. And that, for one thing. And the second thing is, when you say, "I want to pray for the LGBTQ community, that doesn't mean that I now feel safe. Are you praying for me to no longer be gay? are you praying for me to pray the gay way and find Jesus, or are you praying that I'm going to be treated like a human being? And I think that it, to the extent that there needs to be diversity, it doesn't mean that we allow hate speech, and it doesn't mean that we allow for people that might feel uncomfortable to be made to feel comfortable at my expense. So the pushback there, I think, is like, I don't think that Jesus would come in and be like, all right, homophobic person, you get to feel comfortable here at the expense of this other person not being allowed to share who they are. And I think that maybe that speaks a little bit to the uncomfortability that was spoken about last night, when we're uncomfortable in worship and we're uncomfortable in prayer. And so diversity doesn't mean that we get to allow hate speech to happen, and it certainly doesn't mean if someone really doesn't, that we shun what we believe and we quiet down what we believe because we're afraid of losing members. I don't think there's anything Christian about that.
Mm-hmm. Earlier this year at the worship symposium here at Calvin, there was a Palestinian Christian who was talking about public prayer and said, and other ways that people are formed through worship, and said, we have to be careful that we're not reflecting, but instead that we're forming. In other words, that we're not just reflecting the culture, but that we really are oriented towards formation. And that, of course, sometimes does require discomfort, right? But people have to have the expectation within the church that sometimes that it includes membership is demanding, and sometimes will include discomfort.
Well, right? A pastor of the church has said to me, basically, we don't like black people. There was a white traditional congregation of people over the age of 72 who lived through the 50s, and,
right.
We like you. And I'm like, well, that's nice. That means I'm going to get lynched tonight or what? I mean, you understand? And that was, they sort of laughed and I laughed, but I understood that the apprehension and fear of their neighborhood had changed, and they don't want to live there. So their context of worship was no longer sort of like, we can't do the work that we know you can do. So we're not going, your support for outreach in this now multicultural ethnic community, even though it's still middle and high class, we're not doing. We're just going to keep coming to your 9:30 service. By 10:30, we're out. We'll give you some money. Keep doing that, Reverend Blair. But we ain't, we be clear, we ain't doing that. Because that ain't what we, and we just want to die here in the traditional service and make sure if you're around then, bury us a traditional way. And I just shook my head and said, well, that's the best I'm going to get. You understand? I mean, I was out and about doing what I do, but I knew that congregation from 9:30, that's all they want. And that was just a realization. And any praying and chanting and burning candle and laying a hand and casting out demons wasn't going to do nothing for them except put them right back where they were, because their context was not going to shift. So I, that's just the way my world for 3.5 years.
I thought this conversation was going to be about how we advocate as Christians when we're walking through Target.
Oh.
And what's hilarious is the conversation is still so internal. Like, it's still in the sanctuary. It's still in the sanctuary. We can't, we're plural. Yeah.
But
it's
isn't
not the pluralistic world, it's the pluralistic church.
But I think that might be a good place to end. If we think about worship as not just this crucially important experience, not just in that space of worship, but also because of how it sends us. But if we're not really focusing on what it means to form good citizens within the worship setting, then we're really not sending the people into Target or wherever else out in the world to act as citizens. In a sense, citizenship is this inescapable part of every person's life. For the church to forget that at this key moment in its life every week is a problem for how we're engaging the world.